What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Above Board Podcast. And today we have Matthew Marcoux with us. Matt, what's going on, buddy?
Hello, John. It's good to be on our podcast. You make this seem like it's your own podcast, and I just happen to be the guest for today. We are co-owners, and along with the Rich B, we're a three-legged monster here that is this podcast. And
listen, I'm going to give you both guys a little bit of crap about it because I've done the last number of episodes, and someone asked me, they're like, hey, is Rich and Matt coming back? And, you know, yes, the answer to that is yes. Rich has a very busy schedule, and Matt is buried under a beautiful tax season. This happens to him every time this time of year. And that's what we're going to be talking about.
I go into hibernation. I first of all, become very popular. Everyone wants to talk to me. And then I go back into obscurity once April comes and goes. So it's good to be here. It's good to you know, be back in front of all of our listeners and, you know, talk about some very exciting stuff today.
Well, and we're going to try to make it, we're going to try to make tax, because taxes, I don't think taxes is very exciting, but we're going to try to make it at least useful and interesting and as exciting as we can. So first thing, Matt, I'd like to ask you, how do you do tax evasion? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, the definition of tax evasion is 7 to 10 years in prison. We practice tax avoidance, boom, which is using the code to our favor and staying within the realms of legality. And that's how it's done, John.
Beautiful. Obviously, that was a joke. But I do get this a lot. We do tax planning for our own clients. It's not really a service that we advertise outward beyond our client base. But something that comes up a lot is, can you file your taxes yourself? Or there's a disadvantage to filing yourself. Like, a lot of people just do a TurboTax or whatever. What are your thoughts on self-filing versus working with a professional?
Well, even just to back up for a second, you mentioned why CanderPath does not do tax returns for everybody. And I'd like to address that. And tax planning really falls into two camps. One is that it's a very transactional business. If you go to an H&R Block, if you see a CPA, and you're an individual, you don't own a business, you see them once a year and you get your taxes done, and it's very transactional, right? You do it, and it's a volume business for that CPA or that firm, because they've got to get 1,000 returns in at whatever, a couple $100 each. And that's what they basically base their year off of. Here at CanderPath, we are first a financial planning firm. And part of our financial planning arm does involve tax planning, because for our clients, a lot of our investment decisions, a lot of their retirement planning is first based upon what is oftentimes the largest bill, which is the tax bill. So for us, it's taking a really hands-on approach, and that's just not something that we can offer every single person who calls our office. So we do exclusively our tax planning for our clients here at CanderPath, but that doesn't mean we can't spread our message. That doesn't mean we can't talk to the public about some good strategies and just some good things. So first of all, can you do your own? And I think that depends. Could I change the oil in my truck? I absolutely could. However, what happens if I forget to put that little bolt in that is the drain bolt? What happens if I forget to do that and I do everything right? I change my filter correct. I put in the right amount of oil and I just drive down the street thinking everything is fine and realize, wait, I just left all of the oil in the driveway. So yes, you can do it, but should you do it, I guess, is more of the point. And I think that those have a really good aptitude for attention to detail and maybe understand some of the tax elements, and maybe it's simplistic. Maybe you just have a single W-2. It's not, nothing's crazy. Yeah, absolutely. You can have that done. And there's, you know, a lot of great technology out there these days that can help you and maybe just make sure you're not, you know, stepping into any landmines. But for our clients and for those that have a little bit more of a complicated situation, certainly hiring a professional might seem more expensive. But if there is some tax savings done because we can employ a strategy that you might not have known about, or you know, position things in such a way. For us, I think for our clients, you know, the reason why we do the return in a lot of situations is because we do the planning throughout the year. And in order to plan, we have to do it. That way we can base our financial plans off of a pro forma. So, you know, I think it really just depends on the complexity, and everyone's capable. I'm certainly not a rocket scientist. So if I can do it, anyone can do it. But, you know, you just got to be careful and want to make sure. The last thing I'll say on this subject is, you don't generally find out there's a problem until about, depending on what the problem is with the IRS, you don't generally find out until about a year or so later. Some errors do pop up immediately, and that's generally just because you put the wrong number in and it doesn't match up with their system, and it's an automated issue that can just be easily corrected. But you don't typically find out about a problem until about a year later. And by that point, you've already moved on in your life. And so again, having a professional in your life, A, can make sure that hopefully those errors don't pop up, or B, when they do, you have someone to go back to say, how in the world do I fix this? I made a mistake. Or sometimes, and the IRS is not perfect, they've made a mistake and you need to defend yourself. So a couple of things to think about when you're deciding whether to go with a professional or whether you're going to try this on your own. And there's really no wrong answer.
Well, you still have your podcasting chops. There was no rust to shake off here. That was an awesome answer.
I mean, you throw a softball my way, John. I'm going to smack it out of the park.
It definitely was. We totally didn't pre-plan these questions. So something I've seen a lot for folks is, I think it also depends on the personality. Some people like to have control. They like to do the return themselves. They've been doing it that way for a really long time. And I don't know. I mean, it depends on the personality of people. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with going online and doing it yourself through the number of platforms that offer it. But there usually is at some point in your life, not always, but for certain situations, you hit this level of complexity where it becomes just a little too much. So for example, one that I often see with clients is, you know, they've been doing it themselves for years and then they acquire a rental property or they move and they keep their old home and they're going to rent their old home. And for me, that's a situation that usually calls for, because now that we have a thing called a Schedule E, which is like your rental income component of your tax return, that's where it starts to become a little more complicated than if you were like, all you're doing is entering in your W-2 and, you know, answering questions through TurboTax. Schedule E becomes a little more complicated. What other situations do you typically see where maybe it's the switching or jumping off point for someone to go, okay, I need a professional? What's another good example
that you can think of? The Schedule E one. I like for those that have a rental property, and it's not because you can't do it. Listen, if you have a rental property, it's not rocket science, right? And really a lot of these situations, it's income coming in and it's expenses to offset the income. But specifically with rental properties or any rentals for that matter, is there's a small component called depreciation. And this is probably the topic that I educate most of our clients on who do have rentals, is they don't realize that property must be depreciated. In fact, if it's not depreciated by the client, the IRS, when you do go to sell it at some point down the road, says, well, you should have depreciated, therefore we're going to recapture all of that depreciation. So the error doesn't happen while you're doing the return. The error really happens down the road when you sell it. And so for, again, a lot of our clients, it's making sure that they're not stepping in a landmine when it comes to rental property. And the second one is small business. You know,
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. There's so many, what can I deduct? What can't I deduct? One of the nice things about how we organize a client's small business is generally on the Schedule C. And lines 8 through 27, you can pull up a Schedule C if you're listening alongside this or at some point, but lines 8 through 27 actually give us the topics of what deductions can be taken, or at least a general category of those. So okay. I like educating our clients, and especially when they don't know where to even begin. So the IRS kind of gives us a little bit of a blueprint of what are the categories, and that's anywhere from advertising to legal and professional services, depreciation. Again, if you're buying equipment and things like that for the business, that has to be properly depreciated. Meals and entertainment, if they're applied to the business and they're within the realms of legality. So there's a lot of topics. And I just had a meeting with a client yesterday, as a matter of fact. And she's, I'm starting a business. What are the things that I should look for deducting? And I basically pulled up tax form Schedule C and said, hey, here's 21 categories. Now there's going to be more things and there's going to be things outside of that, but here's a good start for you. And so some of the things that the IRS does for us gives us a little bit of an insight of where do we begin. And so again, I think those are the two biggies, is a rental property, a small business. I think if there is a specific situation, I'm dealing with another client right now who has a high amount of student loans. And one of the strategies is for us, they're a married couple. They have a high amount of student loans. Those student loans are based upon income repayment. And so they came to me to say, well, Matt, the income repayment number is way higher than what we can afford right now. What are some strategies that we can do? And one of those is to take a look and see, does married filing separately make sense for them? and still, again, following all of the rules that were given. But you need a professional for that. A married filing separate return is its own beast. And there's some ins and outs. There's some upsides and downsides to it. So there's always these one-off situations, John, that come up that you can Google it, but you're busy running your life and doing your thing. This is where a professional could come in and, you know, for a cost, for a fee, it's not free, to be able to, you know, make sure that it's being done correct. And in that couple situation, you know, the savings that's going to happen because of this income repayment on their loans is going to far out exceed the tax bill that's going to come from a disadvantaged filing of married filing separately.
Well, that's all, honestly, that's more in the realm of that. That is the connection of the tying to financial planning and taxation, because you're doing some planning there for that individual situation. I have a meeting later today discussing the exact same topic. And you're right. I mean, you can Google anything. I mean, if you have a medical condition, what's the first thing we do is we Google the symptoms. And it's just always the scariest outcome when you Google it. And then you go to the doctor and you actually diagnose and you do CT scans or MRIs or x-rays. Like, you actually get to the understanding or the root cause of it. And I think it's a little bit of the same thing in our profession. You can Google something and get confusing or conflicting answers. But when you work with a professional that understands the whole, like the plethora of the situation, like all the variables that go into that situation, I think that's a big deal. I don't want to spend a ton of time on the 1099 side, but I do have one more question or two more. And a part of it's because a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurial, you know, they are starting businesses, have businesses or what have you. I think we have an interesting split where a lot of our listeners are either in that camp or they're retirees. And we'll answer some retiree questions in a moment, but let's stay on the 1099s. Can you give us some quick, maybe two do's and don'ts with the 1099. So like one that comes to mind for me is making sure if you're a 1099 individual, making sure you're tracking your mileage, if that's applicable, you know, tracking your mileage, like keeping your stuff organized. So your receipts organized or your expenses organized on one credit card. That's maybe another example. Do you have any thing that comes to mind for that situation where you were going to the IRS's website and showing that client, hey, here's some things. Like, maybe give us an idea of a surprise deduction you wouldn't expect.
So we're talking to those small business owners. Again, medium to large size business owners really needs a specialist in our industry, right? So I kind of look at myself as more of a generalist. We mostly deal with individuals, small businesses, trusts, closely regarded entities, those types of things. What we don't do in-house is large corporate returns. And so we're going to take that out of the equation for this particular conversation. We're going to talk about small business. And for those small business clients, as you just mentioned, the do's and don'ts. First of all, whether you get a 1099 or not, if you received income, it's taxable. So that'd be the first thing that I get, because I get a lot of people that said, well, I had a bunch of gig jobs and I didn't get a 1099. And you know, if I have to be completely frank, that doesn't really matter whether you got a tax form or not. If you received income, that truly belongs in your tax return if we're going to go from a strict compliance standpoint. So whether you get one or not, that is sort of immaterial. If money hits your bank account from a side gig or from, you know, or whatever small business you might own, that's still your responsibility to report whether you get a tax form or not. Mm-hmm. That's going to change a lot here in the future. And we'll talk about this here, I think, a future question that we get here on today's episode. But, you know, whether it's from a Cash App, whether it's from PayPal or Venmo in the past.
1099-K is coming up next.
Yeah, a lot of those flew under the radar in the past. That's going to now become more prominent in future years because the IRS realized that there's probably a lot of money passing hands that's not being reported right now. So the first thing I'd say, John, to answer your question is just because you didn't get a form doesn't mean it doesn't have to be reported. The second, I do like to compartmentalize those accounts. What I hate seeing is when a client has a small business or side gig, all of the money is being commingled with their personal assets, right? It's all going to their regular checking account. And then I go to ask questions and they're pulling out, you know, various expenses and sometimes income that maybe it's not even applicable to the situation. So really compartmentalizing. And you are a great example of this. And I'm going to use you is how many bank accounts do you have, John?
13.
Okay. You have 13 bank accounts.
And Marina's number. That's why I can remember it.
You have different reasons for that. Yours is for budgeting purposes. But my example here is that it costs very little to have multiple checking accounts, especially this day and age where they're sort of a dime a dozen. So, you know, having that separate entity, you know, making sure that it's being set up correctly. And there's really three steps to setting up a small business. And this might be for a later day, but I just went through this with a client. Step one is sunbiz.org here in the state of Florida is creating the LLC. Step two is applying for EIN on the IRS website. And then now step three, which we haven't really discussed, but it's now going to the FinCEN, F-I-N-C-E-N. It's the financial, really, it's, they call it the, it's got a scary name. It's talking about making sure that the beneficial owner, the person who actually owns that LLC is a person, and disclosing that. So there's an additional step that that we're going to be discussing that was first implemented here this year in 2024. But there's a three-step process for it. After that, you now have an EIN number. You can open up a bank account and again, start that compartmentalizing of your funds. And then the last but not least is, of course, making sure that our expenses are truly legitimate expenses and really not commingling those personal assets. I think some of the big categories that get flagged is mileage, because that's a really big deduction that a lot of small business owners do take, is making sure those miles are really business miles and it's not, you know, taking your kids to and from school.
And well, and for the record, you can't deduct going from your house to your office either, right?
That's like the commuting rule.
Yeah, that's an important rule to know, because I learned that early on in my career. And so I would deduct if I went to, I was part of the local Rotary chamber here. And so when I would go in the morning from here to Rotary, then Rotary to the office, I think that was allowable. But if I went from here to the office, that is not, that's the part of the commuting rule. It's not allowed.
Yeah, it's the commuting. So, you know, commuting has to be, so I think the mileage is one area that we see. And then the second is meals and entertainment, right? Really gray line there of a deductible business meal versus, you know, you and Jackie going to dinner, you know, one night and writing that off. So, you know, there's some things and some ways we can navigate through that with clients just to make sure they know what is allowed and what is not. At the end of the day, a lot of the stuff we're on the honor system for, right? IRS will accept it until they don't, until they start asking questions. And you don't want to be on the end of that conversation of them saying, tell us more, show us receipts, and you looking like a deer in headlight. And then they say, okay, now show us even more. And you really open up an issue. So it's far cheaper, to be honest, to do it the right way the first time than it is to try to walk the line, get a higher deduction or a higher refund, and wonder for the next 3 years, potentially six, if they're going to flag you for an issue and be in a really bad situation. Because as I mentioned, this doesn't happen until years down the road. And you've already forgotten about it, or you're not prepared to write a five-figure check back to the IRS for a mistake. And we try to catch that on the front end for our clients.
Yeah, can we go back to, that's a great answer. Can we go back to the 1099-Ks, which you mentioned, like with Cash Apps, like Venmo or Zelle or what have you? I mean, that the last 5 years, even longer probably, that was an explosion of just how people transferred money to each other. Yeah, you go out to dinner, you go, you know, do something and someone's, I'll pay for it, Venmo me back. Like that became very normal. But there's new rules, I think, at play when it comes to the 1099-Ks. Can you just explain it a little bit more so people know, okay, this is personal use. Obviously, you need to differentiate between personal and business use, but what are some of the rules to know about this?
Yeah, it's, you know, again, it just was really, it's fairly new. In fact, it's not actually fairly new. It's been for a few years now. But these cash apps and really us practitioners, IRS passes a law, or Congress in this case passes a law or a rule, and doesn't really tell us how to implement it, or kind of catches maybe an industry by surprise. And they're like, we don't know what to do. Or there's so many to do in this situation that the industry goes back to either the IRS or to Congress or the legislature and say, can you buy us some more time? Because you just passed a rule that is really difficult to implement. And we need some time to figure this out. So really the long and the short of it, and I don't want to scare people from using these tools. I use Venmo, I use Cash App, I use PayPal. I'm not going to stop using them. But what I need to be very conscious of is if they're being used in the course of business, as we talked about a moment ago, nothing should change. If I was, you know, using this in the course of business, then I need to be reporting that properly. If it's being used personal, then I also probably just need to keep a little bit better records, or, you know, sometimes on these, you can kind of put a note of what it's for. I think where it starts to get gray and murky, and I'm still learning about this, to be completely frank with you, because this was just passed and we're not quite sure where does it go and how does it work? We have a good idea of it. I'm not saying we don't. It's just, it hasn't happened in practice a lot yet, especially on the personal side. Prior to this rule, there's a really high barrier to be getting a tax form from PayPal. It was $20,000 of money moving back and forth, or, you know, like a high number of transactions, and that bar just got incredibly low. It's now close to $600. And so what we need to just be very careful of, and I think there's just where the gray area slowly starts to come in, and I'm just sort of speaking out loud here as a practitioner, is what happens if you do sell something on Facebook Marketplace, right? So new furniture comes in, you're getting rid of your old couch, you accept $100 from someone on PayPal, you get a 1099-K for that now. You know, you can't report the loss, right? So I can't say, well, I paid $500 for that couch, I sold it for $100, I'm going to take a $400 loss on my taxes. However, if you sold Taylor Swift tickets last year and you paid $100 for them and you sold them for $3,000 on Ticketmaster or PayPal or whatever these are, technically, I mean, there's a gain there, and that gain should be reported. So there is going to be some...
Would you have to make a Schedule C for that gain, or would you... It would be a Schedule C, like a 10.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's some business aspect to that as well, especially if someone is doing that. I mean, what's to say someone's not doing that as their primary source of income?
Yeah. By the way, your numbers are way off for Taylor Swift. That would be like the tickets would have been 3,000 and they would have resold for 9,000, not $100 and 3,000.
I'm off on my pop culture, but I guess, but there could be personal stuff commingled in there. So again, me and you go to dinner. And, you know, we split the bill and so that still might be reported on this form. And then it's up to me as the taxpayer to say, wait, no, that was personal. That wasn't. Or in that couch situation, hey, I paid $500 for the couch. I got $100 for it. I'm not writing that off as a loss, but that $100 also is not taxable income to me. So we're still kind of working through this, which is why really this rule has been delayed for a handful of years, is because it's going to be a little bit messy because of the volume and how people are using this Cash App or this electronic transfer of money. And we're going to see it more and more down the road. And part of my job as an enrolled agent is, and a big part of this is, the number of hours I spend in continuing education, which for each year, I should know this off the top of my head, close to 25 to 30 hours each year over a three-year course. It's 72 hours of continuing education. Part of those each year is learning what happened, what do I have to look forward to, what's changed. And so some of my continuing education that's coming up here this year in 2024 that will apply when we do taxes in 2025 is going to be how to navigate some of these things. So I'm going through testing and reading and literature here now. And that's part of any good practitioner who is a student of their craft, is to learn more about these things so that we can just be armed when this stuff pops up.
Yeah. So to be clear, Matt is an enrolled agent with the IRS. And no, that doesn't mean, I had someone ask me this question, that does not mean he's an IRS agent carrying a 9mm, but he's an EA. And there's a number of different designations that come up. The two big ones that I typically see are an EA, which is what Matt is, or a CPA. And correct me if I'm wrong, is that, so the continued education you're doing, is that for the four-year enrolled agent? Is that your EA, or is that something you would have? Okay.
I would have done it anyway, just as you can be an unenrolled agent, which is someone who has no designation. That's really kind of the scary thing about taxation, is you don't really need any designation to do it. Now, to do it well, you do. And there's really three primary designations that if you're out there looking for someone, these are the three you should look for. The first is a CPA. The second is an enrolled agent. Third is an enrolled actuary or an attorney, a tax attorney, an LLM. And the reason why those are important designations is not so much that they have the expertise, which they do. They have to pass, either a CPA is passing, you know, very comprehensive exam, having a bachelor's degree. The enrolled agent is a three-part, very intensive test, really focused only on taxation, or, you know, an attorney who has an LLM, which is a kind of a master's in taxation. The real reason, John, is because those are only the three groups of people that can actually represent someone in front of the IRS. So at this point, we're not talking about doing the return. We're talking about when there's a problem. Who can represent you? It can only be represented by one of those, or by those three individuals with those proper designations. So much of it is really not on the front end of things. It's really on the back end of things. When there's an issue, who can represent you in front of the IRS? We don't do a ton of IRS representation because we mostly are not dealing with individuals who are on the gray area of the taxation. But there are things that pop up. And so having ourselves in the court for our clients really is a peace of mind strategy for a lot of our clients, in that I can represent them in all areas. Another nice thing about the EA, of course, I'm partial to it, but is I can represent clients in all 50 states. One of the CPA, I'm never going to say anything bad. CPA is the brotherhood of or sisterhood of taxation. They are incredibly important, but a CPA is a very broad designation. I mean, someone could be in taxation, they could be in auditing, they can be in corporate finance. And so it's a very broad designation for my purposes. My designation being a financial planner first and is really taxation is really where I needed my expertise to be honed in on. And then of course we have the attorneys who again, when things really get complicated, we might need to go to a tax attorney if something real sophisticated is going on. So there's different levels of it. None of them are bad. They're all good. It's really just what the practitioner is looking to do with their career, and ours is really focused primarily on taxation.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to our show. Are you looking for shorter daily episodes of Above Board delivered straight to your Amazon Alexa? Join Canterpath 365 and get our daily brief with market updates, financial news, and mini podcast snippets like from today. Sign up now at canterpath365.com and we'll see you there. That's a good point about CPAs. That's not something that you realize, but normally when someone is a CPA and you're not in this industry, you just assume, oh, that person can help with taxes. They're really good at taxes. But if you're a corporate, if you're in corporate finance doing public accounting, like your CPA designation, you probably can do taxes, but that's not your specialty.
It's funny, John, because you're probably going to say this, but we have probably a half dozen CPAs as clients who we do their taxes for, not because they're not capable, not because they don't, but that's not what they do. That's not what they're doing with their CPA licenses. They're working more in corporate finance or some other, it's such a broad topic. So we have one that's in auditing right now, audits 401ks. It has nothing to do with filing taxes. And so they come to us for that level of expertise, and there's a role for each one of us. And I think I might have gone off this point, but CPAs are state regulated. So I mentioned a moment ago where an EA is allowed to work with all 50 states. You know, CPAs are state regulated. So for us, where we have a lot of clients outside the state of Florida, it really makes it a little bit easier that I don't have to go to California to get a licensed there for taxation, or to New York. I did a New Mexico return and an Idaho return, which was the first. And the person who I did it for listens to this show a lot, so he will know what I'm talking about. And that was a learning lesson about some of these states with their odd taxation structures. So
I hate looking at state returns. Like when we, because I, my eyes are so, I can so naturally, I mean, I've seen a million 1040s in our time and working with clients. So I can look through a federal return, but those state returns are so interesting. They're so confusing oftentimes.
I really dislike them. If I had to say what I dislike the most about this is soft. Not because I don't like the states. We live in Florida, so we don't deal with state tax. We don't do a state return. What I hate is that I don't know that it was a 37 states with tax. That means there's 37 different sets of rules.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what gets so frustrating is they all have these little quirks, and it takes so much time to learn that state's little quirk about what do they do different. I mean, I just learned about the Idaho grocery credit for this client, and I had no idea what that was. Had to go research it, figure out what it was. Do we qualify for it? By the way, it was like $20 of Idaho income in there, and so it wasn't enough to even worry about, but I still had to figure this out. And there was another one with Mississippi. The client has more than 8 W-2s. Well, Mississippi doesn't allow electronic filing, so we have to now manually like mail this return in. And I'm not complaining about it. It's just, like I said, these little odd things that you're like, great, now I have to go figure this out. But I'm obviously saying this in jest, and I love what I do, and I love learning about them, but they are very frustrating at times.
Yeah. Well, shifting gears a little bit, these are the questions we get all the time. You know, what are some tax strategies or planning opportunities? And maybe we can sort of combine the tax side and the CFP role that we serve with folks. What are some planning opportunities to minimize our tax liability? So I've had someone come to me before and they say, hey, I'm really thinking about making a sizable charitable contribution so I can lower my tax obligation. I'm like, well, that does work like that, but you're still, if you're making a charitable contribution for the tax reason and not the charitable intent in doing so, that's probably not the right move. You know, you should lead with your intent first. But what other strategies maybe come to mind for you with that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just depends. That's a very broad question. And I know why you threw it out there, because we can go in a number of avenues. But first of all, and we've talked about this before, is tax planning is not done on April 14th, right? It's done throughout the actual calendar year. And I think the first thing is taking a look at right around June or so of the year and saying, okay, I've had 6 months. I've now filed my previous year's taxes. What worked? What didn't? Where is my income landing? I choose 6 months because keep the math easy. The first 6 months I earned this. The second 6 months I'm probably going to earn this, and can sort of figure it out. Tax minimization can come in two forms. One is just looking to see what my refund's going to be, and am I going to owe $10,000 or get $10,000 back? That doesn't change the tax bill. The tax bill is the tax bill. And I often have to educate our clients that whether you get a refund or you owe money doesn't mean you paid more or less tax. It just means you did a better job or not so good of a job throughout the year of withholding. Your eyes are on the wrong number. The number really should be what was my tax bill or what was my tax due. That really is the number that we should focus on. And you mentioned a couple of strategies is charitable giving. That has changed here in the past. Again, legislation changes a lot of things with taxation. In the past, our standard deduction, the amount that you were allowed to deduct before itemizing, was a lot lower of a number. This year for a married filing couple, it's somewhere around $27,000. Mm-hmm. So you got to do a lot of charitable giving. You have to have a lot of home mortgage interest, a lot of real estate taxes, a lot of maybe state tax in order to exceed that number. And I find a lot of
people, I'm of the opinion that made things easier for people, for what it's worth. I mean, I think because a lot of people, like, there's a statistic I remember when this all happened. It was like a third of Americans itemized their tax return before the legislation came through. And now it's something like 5%. But I mean, if the number's bigger, it's $27,700 this year. And then there's another step up if you're over the age of 65, I believe. But if that number's bigger, you're still better off. I mean, it ultimately simplifies your return and it gives you a bigger deduction, right?
Let's put it this way. I've gotten a lot less of the goodwill receipts that have just no numbers on them.
I used to do that too.
Right? Like, I've gotten less of those. And I think from a compliance standpoint, the IRS was like, you know what? We're just going to increase this number to try to minimize that, because you do open yourself up for liability if you decide. Yeah. We've had a number of clients where maybe they have $27,800 in deductions, and maybe some of those were those goodwill receipts that they just sort of put a number on. And my advice to them is, gosh, just go with the standard. Why open yourself up for any liability for them to look into these things? It doesn't make sense to do so. Again, going back to those earlier points, it doesn't always make sense to try to gain the system, because problems could develop down the road. Just let's keep this simple. So I think you mentioned that, but there's a few other things and things that have come up here in this tax season, right we're in the middle of. The first, we've talked about this on a previous episode, was health savings accounts, which are sort of like the unicorn of tax deferred and in some cases tax-free accounts, where, if you're eligible for a health savings account and you're a family, or even if you're an individual, there's
$8,300. Yeah.
It's $8,300 in there, $3,700 or $4,000, whatever the number is for an individual. But I have done maybe three or four returns this year where clients were eligible for HSAs, maybe only put in $1,500. And I said, hey, we're already in the new year, but this can be retroactive. Gosh, fill up that bucket of money in the HSA. Mm. And that's a dollar for dollar deduction that comes off. Same as for IRAs, if eligible for doing an IRA, which is super, super.
Or a 401k at your company.
Yeah. Yeah,
I do want to hit home on that HSA comment though, because I think that's putting the planning hat on, where you could fund. I mean, it's only been around for 20 years, but you could fund an HSA, so it's still relatively new. But you could fund it theoretically as a family for the next 20 years or whatever, depending on what age you are. I mean, there's a high chance, and the other cool thing is you can invest those dollars too. And so I always tell people, like, let's make sure we're investing it after. Let's keep in cash enough to cover our out-of-pocket maximums for the year or whatever. But if we're going to look at investing those dollars, let's build this account as a long-term account, so we have a six-figure sum of money in a tax-free vehicle that we got a tax deduction for when we put money in. So that's that unicorn aspect you're talking about. Like, you get a tax deduction on the front end, it grows tax-free, and it could be used tax-free if you use it for medical, but you're going to have a ton of reasons to use it when you're in retirement. And there's, I mean, I could do a whole podcast on the on when you're on Medicare, the ways you can use an HSA, it is so useful. I mean, that is such an important.
I think you got to be careful of who can go onto an HSA plan. And that's probably where this gets into a little bit, but there's this barbell, right? If you're on, if you're on the, if you have a lot of health issues, HSAs make sense. And if you have no health issues, HSAs make sense. If you're in the middle there, HSAs might not make sense because of copays and deductibles, because you're typically your health insurance has less ongoing benefits each throughout the year. And I mean, let's use this person. I'm in year two of my HSA. So for the first, 15 years or so in business, or 18 years, I was on various health, jumping from, as a small business owner, jumping from health plan to health plan. And HSAs never really made sense, especially with young children. So I'm on year two of it. Year one, we put the maximum amount in, only use maybe a few thousand bucks of it. So we put in whatever the $7,500 number was and use a few thousand bucks. Year two, again, we're trying to do as much as we can out of pocket because, like you said, it's a really good planning tool. And try to grow it as much as we can and try to absorb some of those health costs right onto ourselves. But we have some really great resources with technology. Of Teladoc now makes these $100 visits to the, you know, to the pediatrician for our kids, or even for myself or my wife, is in our cases, some of them are free now. So I'm able to mitigate those expenses using technology and keeping those costs low. My premiums are fairly low because it's a very high deductible plan. But you really need a good 3 years, right? I think, is sort of what I calculated, of no major incidents over the beginning span of those HSAs to build up enough. Because again, that my deductible is probably north of 10,000. And while we can absorb that, I really love having that available to me inside of the HSA to be able to use. But this is a tangent.
That is a good point. It's hard on the front. Everything's hard at the beginning. It is harder on the front end to get through that window of time where once you can push past that and really start growing it, that's where it becomes useful. So I think that's a good point. So HSAs, that's one of them. 401ks and IRAs, that's another really good strategy. One I want to ask you about is timing of deductions. So I've personally done this, and this is all within the rights of the US tax code. But I mean, and I've seen other clients do this too, where, so let's say maybe they're charitably inclined, but they want to take advantage of in 1 year, like in 2023, let's say they took the standard deduction. They didn't make their charitable contribution until 1/1 of 2024 for the prior year. And then they make their charitable contributions for 2024 as well. So they kind of double up in the tax year, their charitable contribution. And the other one I've seen a lot of people do too is like their, because some of the other things you can write off are like the interest on your home loan, on your primary residence, and your property taxes. So I see this, people do this too, because you can pay your property taxes in Florida anywhere from November all the way through March. So they'll pay it in January for the prior year, and then they'll pay it again in November for the current year. So you have this influx, this surge of expenses, because you've doubled up your property taxes, you've maybe doubled up your charitable contributions in 1 year. So every other year you take the standard and then you itemize, and take the standard and then you itemize. I'm seeing that more and more. Are you seeing that as a strategy at all?
Yeah, I've seen that. It, you know, it takes a lot of planning. It has to make sense. I think oftentimes if there's more of an anomaly in income, maybe someone got laid off and income is lower, maybe some of those strategies, like it usually is precipitated by like an event that occurs, maybe a huge bonus hit and we want to take as much as we can that year. The other thing that and this is a little bit of a tangent, but you asked about what are some other things, is I think capital gains. It's something we just talked about this morning on our investment committee meeting, was the timing of capital gains. Remember how capital gains work. Again, if you have a brokerage account, a non-qualified account, and there's stock inside of it, or a mutual fund or an ETF, those typically, you know, what you paid for it and what you can sell it for. If there is a gain there and that gain is over a year and a day, it's considered long-term. If it's under a year and a day, it's considered short term. There's a dramatic difference on the taxation between the two of those. And so some things we were talking about this morning for our clients is, when is the prime time to maybe harvest either some gains, or maybe they came to us with some positions that are at a loss and we want to reallocate those, get them, you know, into the right mixture of investments and harvest some of the losses. And maybe that happens even throughout the year. I can think of years like 2020 or years where there's been big movements in the market. If you remember 2020, of course we all do, is the first 6 months of the year, basically, the market just went down as COVID was coming about and people were scared and the markets were scared. You know, some harvesting was done there, at least on our part, of selling some positions and then immediately repurchasing those to harvest some of those losses. And then that second half of the year was all gains. I'm not saying we hit the nail on the head and we were not prognosticating it, but I'm using this as an example of being able to harvest losses if a loss does occur in a brokerage account, or in this case that we were talking about this morning is harvesting gains. We're at all-time market highs here. I'm not saying whether it's the time to do that or not, but for our clients where we have a very specific strategy or allocation, we follow a very rules-based investing process. So if we need to harvest or we need to rebalance the portfolio, it's making sure we're taking from long-term gains. Maybe we're timing those gains with, you know, where the client's income is that year. And one of the scenarios is we need to actually make a change, but the gain will not be long-term until May for one of our clients that we're working with right now. So we are delaying the shifting of the accounts, the changing of the funds around until we can hit that long-term, because they're in a very high tax bracket and we don't want to trigger any undue tax issues. So I would much rather get a long-term gain, which has a capped tax rate, versus a short-term gain. And that short-term gain typically follows whatever your ordinary income tax rate is. So it is highly advantageous in a number of scenarios to make sure your gains are long-term rather than short-term. So I think that's another planning aspect, John, as you talked about deductions and IRAs and HSAs, is if you have a brokerage account and you're investing and there's time for a change, is timing that change with some strategy in mind.
That's cool. That's a great point. And I have one more that I want to ask you on, and we'll wrap on that. And it'll be five things. Do you remember back in the day when the podcast, early on, anyone that listens to this podcast remembers this, when it was the Three to Win podcast? And we'd have a topic, but then we'd apply like one thing for that topic. And so we'd have three things that you could take away as a key takeaway for it. Do you remember
that? A long time ago, man. I don't know I barely remember what I had for dinner last night, let alone what happened 3 years ago.
Our first ever podcast, the first ever one we recorded, we sat in my office and the three of us sat around one microphone about this close to each other's faces. Do you remember this? We all talked into one microphone. It was, and I think like the moment we finished recording, we're like, we all need mics, and then we invested in better mics for all three of us.
That anyway, had been an audio nightmare of separating out tracks and figuring out volume levels. I mean, goodness.
It's terrible. It's anyone can go back and listen to it. I don't encourage you to, or do it, whatever. I don't know. But the first episode, if you listen to it like in the car or like with AirPods on, you can hear, I think it's like your voice is here, my voice is on the right ear, yours is on the left ear. Like you can just hear the soundtrack moving. It's so wild. Anyway, so the summary of the five, which I like summarizing this, of just ideas or some tax strategies would be contributing to an HSA, contributing to a retirement account, that could be a 401k or an IRA if you're eligible, deduction timing, if it works for your scenario, it's complicated, but it could work, monitoring capital gains, you know, being able to balance losses and gains there within your investments. And the last one I want to talk about is QCDs. And we could do a whole, I mean, I've done a charitable giving presentation that's 30 minutes and it's only been QCDs. So, but I want to give a little shout out to the retirees that hang with us on this podcast, because this is an important one. So if you're over the age of 70 and a half, now most people, you apply this for their required minimum distribution, which is basically the IRS tells you have to take a certain amount of money out when you turn 73. That's the new number this year, right? 73 for the RMD. But the QCD is if you're over the age of 70 and a half, you can take instead of taking a distribution from your IRA while you're also simultaneously giving to your church or giving to a charitable organization that you care about, and you're not getting the credit for it potentially because you're just taking the standard deduction. So like you're giving these charitable contributions to places, but you're not giving enough to take the deduction. You can, instead of taking that distribution from your retirement account or your IRA, you can actually send that to the charitable organization in lieu of writing a check. And that is not a taxable event. Is that a good summary of how a QCD works?
It's a really good one. I like that a lot. And I think what's super cool about this from a very geeky tax perspective is, like, as you mentioned, in a lot of situations with the standard deduction being so high, if you're charitably inclined and you're taking your required minimum distribution, i.e. over the age of 70, now 73, that you were giving and you were doing it because you wanted to give. And that's fantastic. And I believe that should be the way that you do your giving and charitable. However, if you, again, can follow the rules of the tax code by giving to charity from your required minimum distribution, it has to be in a very specific manner. And we work with our clients really closely on that. It does two things. As John mentioned on the obvious, you actually take the deduction. So if your required minimum distribution was $10,000 and you said, well, each year I give $8,000 to my church, you and that $10,000 would have been taxable as you distributed out of your IRA. You know, $8,000 goes to the charitable organization. Maybe you claim $2,000 of it. It does two things. One is it allows that deduction to take place. The second, I think this is really where a lot of people miss, is how Social Security is included in your taxable income.
And the way you're collecting Social Security at this by this age.
You're also, you're collecting Social Security if you're over age 70. You kind of have to because it doesn't grow anymore. Yeah. And your Social Security inclusion is dependent upon what your other income is. So it could be anywhere from 0% of your Social Security is included in your taxable income all up to 85%. By using this strategy, you are reducing your other income, which then reduces the amount of Social Security typically that can be included in your taxable income. Of course, every scenario is going to be a little bit different, but speaking in a very broad manner, it does two things because of that Social Security inclusion piece. And I love seeing when something that you just don't see on the onset, it really has a material impact, especially with our retirees who are oftentimes on fixed income. Again, sometimes the tax bill is the largest bill that they have, besides maybe from their Medicare, which John does a terrific job of making sure that it's being planned ahead of time for. But it's one of those double whammies that if you're already giving, you might as well give from there as opposed to giving from your checking account. Church or charitable organization, they don't care where it comes from. And now you have almost a double whammy on your taxes of reducing your taxable income and at the same time reducing that Social Security inclusion. It's one of those. It's like the HSA we just talked about a moment ago for our working clients. It's that same thing for our retirees.
I have a actual client scenario where it was so cool because we didn't talk about IRMA yet, which is a surcharge for Medicare. And the folks that are in this phase of life, when we're talking RMDs, QCDs, and Medicare, you know what I'm talking about with IRMA. So in this scenario, the client, his RMD was like around 25,000 and he happened to gift around 20. And so when he had to take his RMD at 73, the conversation came up. Well, if you're giving to charity over here on this side, and you're not getting a deduction for it, by the way, because you know your $27,700 is the standard deduction, let's flip this around. Instead of writing a check to these organizations, gift it from your RMD, and you don't pay taxes on that, of course. And what it ultimately did was it lowered their tax bill in such a way that it, of course, it saved them on. I think it even dropped them a tax bracket, actually. So it saved them on taxes, but it also saved them on their IRMA, on their surcharge for Medicare tax. I mean, it was like an $8,000 swing. I mean, this is a really cool part of planning that we get to do with people where we see just by sort of shifting how we do things that you're potentially already doing and you can save thousands of dollars. It's super cool.
I think for our minds, everyone's like, how could you do taxation and finance? Gosh, that's such a daunting. And I think for you and me, I've heard this said by one of my close buddies who's in the insurance industry. He sort of said it to me. Mike said to me, he said, it's almost like every situation is a puzzle and I get to put the pieces together. And for whatever, if you've ever done a jigsaw puzzle, you know how satisfying it is when that piece kind of fits right in where it's supposed to go. I think that's the only way that I can possibly describe what it is that we do is one is we generally love helping people. But also I love when those puzzle pieces just like fit together. You know, it's so satisfying that they fit together. It works. It's within the parameters of all the rules that are set in place. And it's a true win following the rules and then maximizing all of our strategies. For me, when I lay my head down on the pillow at night, it's knowing that puzzle fit together was such a feat of accomplishment. And that's how I feel on a daily basis. Not always. Sometimes we have to cut the pieces of the puzzle to make them fit. And if you've ever done a jigsaw puzzle and you can't figure it out, it's happened. But when they do fit, it works awesome. And that's a really good example of Medicare and taxation and gifting and Social Security and all of those things coming together. It makes whatever we charge to those clients so minimal in comparison to the impact that we're providing. And our clients generally see that and love that aspect of working with us. So yeah, it's a real cool experience.
Yeah, that's a solid point. I was still hoping you'd give us some tax evasion strategies, but you didn't do that. So good job. You passed the test. But I think this was such a good conversation. I mean, if you follow us on social all our this entire month, because I mean, everyone's doing their taxes right now. So this entire month is all about tax, like preparing for taxes and planning and that type of stuff. And we wanted to come on and do an episode about it where, and not just talk about, hey, organize your taxes. And like, that's duh, right? That's important. But give some really useful takeaways for 1099 Ks. Like you did a video on that the other day. I didn't even know some of that information, like the threshold drop from 20K or whatever it was to 600. This is incredible. So appreciate you doing that and excited for the coming weeks when tax season is behind us. And then we get our co-host back with you, Matt. So this is a fun one. And again, just a reminder, the five key takeaways. So HSAs, 401Ks, IRAs, deduction timing, capital gains, and QCDs. Matt, anything you want to add to it before we wrap?
No, I mean, I think there's been a lot of talk about backdoor Roth conversions. And I think maybe we do a part two of this at some point with maybe some advanced strategies of some things that like is on the fringe of maybe doesn't help us today, but helps us long term and maybe some posturing of some cool strategies. So we can always continue to expand upon this. But most importantly, we love hearing from those that are listening to this and our clients who listen to this and the publics. And what is it they love to hear about in some of these areas? Or sometimes it's, Matt, this is why we have you to figure it out for us. And we just need to be aware of some of these strategies. So we love hearing from everyone who listens to this podcast. We truly pour our heart into it. And every topic might not be the most exciting, but I think all of it's relevant. And we try to keep those topics really relevant to what's going on at life right now.
I find them exciting.
I know you do.
I think it's exciting. All right. I'm going to put ourselves out on a limb. I'm going to throw our text line out there so people can, because I think what you mentioned is really good. Like we love soliciting feedback for episodes we do, guests that we have on the show, that type of thing. So if you have that kind of feedback and you'd like to obviously like rate and like us and subscribe to us on our podcast, but if you'd like to send us that feedback, you can send us a text at 407-904-8414. Gosh, your team's going to be so mad at me that I just shared that, but I think it'd be a cool, it's good to have feedback from our listeners so we can, you know, do more of these types of things. So anyway, thank you guys all for hanging with us. Matt, thanks for dropping some wisdom and knowledge on us during this tax season. I know you're busy, so appreciate you hanging with us, and we will see you all next week on the Above Board podcast. Bye guys.